This is GamesAtWork.biz with Michael Martin and Michael Rowe, your weekly podcast about gaming technology and play. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone and not the opinions of any organization which we have been, are, or may be affiliated with. This is episode 285, Two Left Feet. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon. Michael Rowe here on a wonderful, happy Friday for everyone in the world, everywhere.
Hooray!
It's Friday, except Friday. When you listen to this, it won't be Friday anymore, so it doesn't really matter. I'm here with my friend.
You might be recording it next Friday, or listen to it next Friday, though.
So you could if you're really slow.
There's a 1/7 chance.
Yes,
1/7 chance.
It could be listened to. That it is a Friday when you listen to this show, and for that, I say thank you. So, I'm here with my friend and co-host, Michael Martin. Michael, how are you?
Yahoo! I am doing great, and I am all set to put my best foot forward for today's show and all the articles and stuff that we got. How about you?
I am too. I'm going to put both left feet forward. So speaking of feet.
So speaking of feet and measurements and everything else, let's start things off with a New York Times article about, and it's funny here that they're talking about meteorologists, but apparently, you know, a meteorologist and others use measurements in a lot of different ways. And I did not know that there are two official foot measurements, and one of those is about to disappear. Go away.
Yeah, it's funny. I saw this article too, and I don't think I saw it on the Times. I saw it on another feed, but it was interesting because I've got rulers. And when I first saw the article, I didn't dig deep. I just said, oh, yeah, because, you know, a wooden ruler shrinks over time compared to a metal ruler. And then I read the article, and it's like, So we just can't make up our mind on a unit of measure. I know at least the meter is pretty consistent, right? Because it was defined as a piece of distance based off of the circumference of the Earth, if I remember correctly. And then they cast the official meter in a piece of unchangeable metal.
Yes.
Right? And they said, if you ever want to know the size of a meter, it's right there. So how did we get 2 feet?
Well, you know, to me that was kind of funny because it was the story as I recall it. And I hadn't done any research on this either, Michael. Is that they used the king's foot to originally create the measure of what a foot was? It was a king's foot, and apparently, going back in time, stepping back in time.
And you know how an inch used to be like this part of your, the from the knuckle to the hand of your thumb, if I remember. Or was it the first and second knuckle on your pointer?
It could be. I mean, they're all about that size. But anyway, there were two different feet. There was one that was used by surveyors.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one used by lots of other people. And so if you're trying
everyone else.
So if you're trying to do a survey foot, and granted, you're probably not buying property like a 1 foot square, you know, you're buying them.
I don't know. Have you seen some of those hotel rooms in Japan?
Some of them are pretty tiny.
And my apartment in New York was pretty tiny. An extra square foot would have been huge.
You know, actually, I think I do have a deed somewhere of like 1 square foot of an island that I bought from one of the Cards Against Humanity things that they did one holiday season. So, yeah. So I think actually I probably do have 1 square foot on an island that I could go and plant a flag and say it was me. And that's what I own. But anywho,
the Principality of Martine.
Kind of, yeah. I got a chance to you know do something like that. I actually had a chance too. I was king for an hour or something because Cards Against Humanity bought a castle, so there was like one small space of time that I was king or something. I could have used my foot. Jeez, you know that would have been fun. But if you zoom in really, really teensy wise, you can see that 1 foot is a tiny bit shorter than another. And it was one man's mission here to say, you know what, let's unify our feet. let's take that step. Let's make sure that this doesn't happen anymore, and make it clear for everyone that if you're buying a big piece of land, you know precisely where things are, and that everybody will agree, whether it is the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers or the folks that are your realtor or whoever else. So I saw this and I thought this was really rather funny, and I remember the same thing too about the metric system, Michael, and you know the a pound's a pound the world round, and you know all these other aspects. So you wouldn't have thought that there would be this much debate still around a unit of measure that you thought was normal, right?
Well, and especially given the importance of geospatial data in the Internet of Things and in all the different systems that we've been developing in modern technology, whether you're talking about self-driving cars, whether you're talking about weather systems based off of altitude of wind, whether you're talking about, you know, diving bells or drones. Distance is important to be exact, especially as you get into self-driving and autonomous vehicles where you're, you know, whatever the vehicle is, whether it's a submarine or a plane or a car, you want to know how far you are away from. Inches matter. Exactly.
Yeah, so fun article. Have a look at it. You might find some other things. And, you know, so speaking of things hidden in plain sight, you know, yes, differences between cool. 2 feet. There were several articles around the idea about having a spy gadget that Q may have given to James Bond. In the case here, this was a U.S. government element to take an iPod, and how in the secrecy specific company that makes iPods, how such a thing even happened. And, That was just a fantastic story in my book about how you have a secret wrapped in a secret in a donut hole inside of a donut hole.
Yeah, so this one's really specific, right? This is talking about an iPod with a built-in Geiger counter.
Yeah.
That was built by a couple of engineers at Apple by direct direction of a senior vice president working with, you know, the government came in, said, we need this. You will create it. You have the technology and you can't tell anybody about it. So it's funny with all the news, rumors and hype around whether various countries would leverage the communications infrastructure that's being rolled out to snoop on others. It's interesting because if you have a government actor and a company that is in the country of that government, you can be required by law to do things that is not in benefit of your customers, that are very targeted, very specific, and, you know, they worked hard on this to make sure it was not detectable either. So, you know, just getting a router and saying, well, I ran, virus software against it to see, scanning software against it to see if there was anything in, and it's fine, doesn't tell you squat, right? Because with the right incentive, and that could either be patriotism or financial, if you have access to the physical device at time of creation, you can do things. And this one, you know, it's to your point, the secretive company. This was done right under Steve Jobs' nose, as the article title says. And he was notorious for wanting to know everything and not telling things, right? So this was kept from him.
Well, yeah, right. And I mean, that's what it says. But I don't know if I believe that either, knowing as much as I know about the guy and having read as much as I've read about him as well, that the idea that this would be obscured even from him seems a little strange to me.
Well, in all fairness, I mean, this is a couple of engineers somewhere in the bowels of the company.
Yep.
I mean, does the CEO of McDonald's know how much mustard is put on every hamburger? I doubt it.
Yeah. But, you know, if there was a microphone placed in the mustard, he might want to know. Actually, you know, the other thing that kind of grabs me here too is that going back to the movies for just a minute or three, Q didn't necessarily go to Aston Martin and say, hey, I want you to secretly build in these defense mechanisms into your car, right?
So it does an oil spill.
Yeah, and he didn't go to Mont Blanc and say, hey, I'd like you to put a laser beam, or sorry, laser into your pen.
And, air quotes on an audio podcast. Yeah,
there you go. This is awesome. And third, or is that C? I don't remember. Going to a watch manufacturer and, you know, putting something secretive in said, you know, timekeeping device either. The iPod shell, and I have a couple of iPods right here with me, incidentally.
Got one in the drawer right behind me.
Yeah. In theory, one should be able to pry it apart and put some things in it. But I guess the whole idea was to make it just absolutely undetectable by anybody else, unless you had a non-Geiger counter version of an iPod that you could also disassemble and say, what's different between these two?
But see, I think that's easy to do too, right? I mean, iPod's a commercial product. You can buy as many as you want.
Yeah.
So this.
So why did you need to go to the engineers? Even
because you want it even more undetectable, to where the average engineer just popping open two iPods would not be able to notice the difference.
Well, but the point here is that they didn't put Geiger counters in every iPod.
I don't know. Or some of that music, they played the Atomic Dog.
Maybe so. I don't know. But, you know.
Was that Bow Wow Wow, Yippee Yippee Bow Wow, Yippee Yippee?
Something like that. You know, it's funny. I was listening with Apple Music on the way coming back from the grocery store earlier today to the Monkees. And there was a best of the Monkees, just kind of speaking of this. And so it was cool to be able to do that immediately without having to have that on my hard drive, because I could just bring it over the air. And it surprised me as I was listening to Daydream Believer and Last Train to Clarksville and all these things about, you know, how good it sounds and how easy it was to go do all those things, you know, just super simple. Just to tie the iPod thing to current thing to now microphone sound thing with another interesting hack element that came across our wires, so to speak, today. Maybe we even tripped over it, dealing with how to clone physical keys by listening. So this article was something that when I read it, it was like, whoa, wait a second. How does this work? Well, the way this works is that you can actually hear the tumblers clicking in a lock. And based upon how it sounds, you can now replicate the key without ever even seeing the key and the ridges in the key. How's that for just like wackiness?
Well, you know, at RSA over the years, they've exposed many different techniques where sound can be used to deduce data in a physical environment, whether that is what people are saying, and you're like, well, of course sound can detect what people are saying, but where it's not auditoriable, is that a word?
Audible.
Yeah, audible. Yeah, that's probably the right word. You know, by looking at the vibrations caused off of panes of glass.
Yes.
Right? The ability to detect the position of things in a room based off of sound waves bouncing around. Think of a bat. And so dealing with the tumblers, right? That historically has been the way that the movie bank robber would break into a vault, right? Listening for the tumblers.
Yep.
So there's definite information there. I find it interesting that they're able to reconstruct the shape of the key based off of the tumbler sounds, because that implies that they're able to put a microphone, a sensitive enough microphone, near enough based off of sensitivity to understand the sound made when the key goes in and is moving the tumblers. And what that really tells me is they're understanding the shape of the wave. Think of it as like a radar, right?
Mm-hmm.
And based off of that, they're able to deduce the visualization of the shape of the key. That just is in a way it makes sense because of radar, but in other ways it just blows you away. And it has to do, I would expect, with both machine learning, right? How they reverse engineered it through machine learning, and more and more accurate physics models to understand how a wave is shaped based off of the material. So I guess, and I haven't been able to read the entire article or watch the video that was attached to it, but could they tell the tumblers if they're made out of plastic versus, say, steel versus some other metal?
Well, I didn't go into that level of detail, but I understand the way you're describing it. I think the thing for me that was just mind-blowing was you don't necessarily need to get a microphone up close to it. I mean, there are boom microphones that you can hear things.
That's why I said within really the sensitive range.
Yeah,
That's what I was talking about, sensitivity. Yeah. It didn't have to be there next to it, but it has to be close enough to have the sensitivity take effect.
Exactly. Right? So they're in the article itself, it does talk a little bit about using Ring doorbells or cameras that have a microphone attached that could be hacked and listen and then use it. So there is
so
that.
So they're able
aspect.
To do it with a single microphone? It's not even a microphone array?
This is what they're saying, right? You know, wow. if you're able to here they say, you know, a victim's smartphone or smartwatch, you know, or other sensors that have a microphone, right? You can hear these things well enough to do it. And if you have a portable replicator, right, you could construct a key essentially on the spot. And you don't go super far with all this to where you start to think about, I need two-factor authentication to get in my front door.
it's certainly going to change the job of a locksmith, right? All they have to do now is have a 3D printer sitting in their car.
Yep. And remember we had something similar about automobile keys as well. And when you think about how there's now proximity detection and handshakes and exchanges of digital key information, it would seem to me that you could use this exact same technique for not just a house and tumbler type situation, but an automobile as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, most locks still have, even the electric locks have a physical lock backup, right? With the tumbler. So.
And if you were able to use ultrasound, strong enough ultrasound, could you move it without even having to have a physical key? Probably not. Anyway, fun to think about, though, isn't it?
No, not at all. Not fun at all.
So we've talked a lot about maps on this podcast over the years. And another article that came through from, in this case, from Mac Rumors, and I've seen some of this enhancements coming through on Apple Maps as of late too, is the richness and level of definition that's coming into maps is continuing to grow and grow and grow. And that shouldn't be surprising to anybody because maps have a tendency of getting better and more accurate, and especially if you can measure what a foot is, those things tend to help you too.
Did we talk about the map problem on this show?
Which map problem?
Well, the one that says you can't ever get an accurate map because maps are fractal by nature, maps of land masses, and if you draw it at one resolution, the circumnavigation of a specific country may equate to a certain distance, but if you go down to the next level and start going into like hills, it's at another. And if you go into every little bump, it's at another distance, right? That the actual fidelity of the map changes the distance of the map.
Oh, interesting.
It's a fractal discussion.
I maybe we did talk about that. I don't remember that right offhand. So,
anyway,
you know,
but I didn't mean to digress, but it's a really interesting thing. And I think when you look at, as you're saying, as the fidelity of these maps become better and better, right, it's a data problem because now I'm going to pump more and more data across the network to your device so you have that great fidelity.
Well, and that's a data problem, and it's one that's being solved with the improvements and latency
compression
and everything else. Yeah, exactly. That is getting solved. What I find really intriguing about all this is that the level of information is now getting much more attuned to the user of said information and making it easier. So the before after pictures here from Google Maps and the updated Maps app, gosh, say all that three times fast, is able to more easily help you distinguish the things that you might be looking for. So if you're trying to hunt down, you know, where is the beach from where I am, you know, you can see
or
that.
Where's the beef?
More clearly, or that too. You know, I do a fair amount of hiking when I have the opportunity, and I oftentimes use a map to say, okay, where am I right now? Just to kind of see where am I in relation to roads and other things.
Yep.
And the topographic information is even, you know, really intriguing now too, because it would say, oh, you know, if I were looking to get home in the fastest way, I might choose that route versus the other one if I could kind of get that bird's eye view up above from where I am. And the street map view is, I thought, another thing that was really intriguing about where are crosswalks, where are sidewalks for folks that require, you know, if you're pushing a stroller around, you want to know how you can best, you know, move around where you need to move around. And kind of similar to what Apple was doing in San Francisco, given like there's so many places where there's stairs, to let you know where there are stairs and you can either choose to use them or avoid them depending on your particular circumstances. So really, really cool map stuff.
Very cool.
I was reminded, too, Michael, of the initial couple of weird things that happened in maps. And we have a little photo album, a shared one between you and I, of some weird things that happened in maps. And
Was when they were trying to render 3D information things based off of a 2D picture.
Yes, yes.
And it was funny.
It's really pretty funny. Yeah, I need to go back and look at a couple of those, because some of those, maybe one of those might turn into the show title picture. I don't know. We'll look.
Could be.
But
especially the one with the person's 2 feet that were, never mind.
the fun example of this that came in, and this was a data problem, going back to your point from a few moments ago, was with Microsoft Flight Simulator announced, open and available. We know friend of the show, Ian, has been out playing it after downloading the 3-point-something gigs worth of data. And nice. By the way, have you downloaded it?
I have not bought this yet.
Oh, well. Hmm. So
we'll get to that probably when we hit another story later.
Maybe, but there's a short period of time, Michael, very short period of time, that you might be able to see the obelisk in the game, because that particular mistake.
I don't want to see bugs.
You don't want to see a bug? You don't want to see a 212-story tall, you know, obelisk thing.
Thing. It's fun. Yeah, this is hilarious. It reminds me of 2001, Odyssey.
Yep.
Right.
So anyway, it was a bug, and it was an error that was made in OpenStreetMaps, and this is why the Bing Maps used that same data. Right, rendered it, and you can fly in and around this. And apparently, I've not viewed this, but there is a video of someone actually landing a plane on top of it, which has got to be
hilarious.
You got to stall it exactly right to.
I guess that means not only is it there, but it has mass. It's not just a graphics bug; it's a map rendering bug with a collision wall, so that you could crash your plane into it.
Ooh, potentially. I don't know. I suppose you probably could, unless it wasn't intended that way, because there's nothing around it that would signal that.
It's not really there, right?
It's not really there. So there's a number of people that are kind of poking fun at Microsoft around these sort of things. The way I see it, these are bugs.
These are bugs, they get fixed.
They get fixed, you know, and it's interesting just in the way that how did these bugs come to be in the game?
Well,
and
it's
what
simple.
It means, I mean, for real mapping.
Think of your regression test of a new version of Microsoft Flight Simulator, right? You're going to do regression tests for things like, are the ailerons working correctly? Is the weather happening right? Do the major maps look okay? Blah, 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 blah. You're not going to fly
everywhere.
Every inch of the Earth to test it, right? It's just too expensive of a test. But by the way, I was reading a blog post recently on average number of bugs in software. It's based off of the book Code Complete 2, which is written by one of the guys at Microsoft, one of the software engineers.
Yeah, and, Steve somebody or another, I think. Yeah,
yeah, and it was saying, you know, in 1,000 lines of code, on average, you have 15 to 25 bugs during development, and you might drop it down to one or two by the time it hits production. Microsoft's techniques that they were using when this book was written, you'd have 10 to 20 bugs, get it down to 0.5, I think, per lines. So half a bug per 1,000 lines of code in shipping code. And there was a theoretical work that was done by a scientist of software engineering at, I think, Carnegie Mellon, who best practices could get it down to, I think it was 3 bugs during development and 0.1 shipping code. Okay, so best practice you can have, 1/10 of a bug for 1,000 lines of code. And I was looking at another story that said that the average luxury car nowadays has 100 million lines of code in it, which means there are 10,000 bugs if you did the absolutely best development you could possibly do in your self-driving car. Bye.
And since each bug has like 6 feet.
And 3 of them are on the left.
And 3 of them are on the left. They're all crawling around in there.
But, you know, it just got me thinking about, you know, how complex systems are nowadays. And you know, a bug could be something as simple as a graphic display problem in Microsoft Flight Simulator.
Yeah, but 10,000 bugs.
Yeah.
And something as complex as a car. I mean, you think about the engineering that has to go into all the mechanical aspects, but there's so much software, as you say, Michael, you know, embedded.
Yeah, and this is all simple math based off of these published papers, right?
Right.
Hopefully, that's an average. And when you're buying that high-end luxury vehicle, you had them do a few more tests.
Well, and there's probably also something like you were illustrating with you know, a display error, right? There are benign
bugs. That's still a bug. Exactly.
They're benign.
That you're not going to fix.
And then there are ones that potentially are going to cause you a bigger problem. And so where my head was going was you look at the advancements Google have been making on map and map software. You look at the crowdsourced element that are in other mapping and open mapping structures, all good stuff. But what happens when you start to route around something that isn't there? Or what happens when something that is there isn't known to be there?
You're going right down my thought process.
Yep. So it's multiple sets of redundancy that are really, really important. So that's where your LiDAR, that's where your cameras, that's where your microphones, you know, all need to be the double, triple, quadruple check, so that like a person doesn't drive into a lake because their car told them to.
You remember, you gotta look. You remember Apollo 13 and the whole failure is not an option. The fact that you have redundant and redundant systems, right? All of that in order to offset the likelihood of a bug.
But we have moved in a direction over our lifetime, for sure, Michael, that redundancy has not been the value. The value has been streamlining. You streamline your value chain. You streamline everything because you're able to reduce cost, and that is the primary objective in a lot of different ways. So it's an interesting balance point where I can see that the interest in redundancy is going to come up significantly because there are so many unknowns that are now happening at such speed. If you haven't built in redundancy in whatever system, political, technological, whatever, it needs to be there.
Right. And this is why, you know, and not to get political, but radical reduction in regulation is not always a good thing, because some of it's there to force the cost and redundancy that if you just looked at price and cost and revenue, you would get rid of it.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So anyway, well, I mentioned why I don't have it yet.
Oh, the flight simulator, now right? I see.
One of the things that would just make it a no-brainer to me was, you know, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, that if I had a VR headset that I could use and actually fly around and use the headset and experience flight simulator at such a level that it was like I was there.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
So... when Facebook acquired Oculus.
Mm-hmm.
And how many years ago was that? That's been a while now. Five, 6 years?
It's been a long time, yeah.
Yeah. One of the big things that was a big concern by people was that you would be required to have a Facebook account to use your Oculus device. And Facebook said, nope, not going to be required, not going to be required. Well, now it's going to be required.
What?
Yeah.
What?
So, for future VR headsets, Facebook login is going to be required.
Yeah. So is there a secondary market for older Oculus headsets where that's not a requirement?
I don't know yet. I'm just saying.
You're just saying?
I'm just saying.
It sounds like
so. I saw this week and I was like,
dang.
Because I don't think it's important to log into Facebook because I want to watch a movie in VR, right?
Hmm.
Or I want to fly around in Flight Simulator.
Interesting. So let me ask you this. So riddle me this, Batman. So if you're not able to move forward with an Oculus to be able to have the virtual reality experience in Microsoft Flight Simulator, mm-hmm. does that mean you need to pick another technology?
Well, I haven't had time to dig into it yet this week to see which other headsets they support.
I see.
But yeah, this is, and it was 2014 when they were acquired. So, gosh, 6 years ago.
Wow. Interesting. So let me ask you this. Is it a deal breaker for you to say that you don't even want the new Flight Simulator if you can't have the VR experience with it?
No, that's not a deal breaker.
Okay. So there is a Microsoft Flight Simulator in your future, no matter what.
More than likely. It just hasn't happened yet.
It's just a matter of time.
Yes.
All right. So you've talked a little bit about changing your virtual reality experience and some things that are going on with Oculus. What if you wanted to change around your menu bar?
Yeah. So I saw this article. I've been using, based off of Andy's recommendation, Better Touch Tool.
Mm-hmm.
For my MacBook Pro with the Touch Bar. And I know I'm in the minority, but I like the Touch Bar. It's kind of cool.
Yeah, it is
I
cool.
use it for stuff. Right? And Better Touch allows you to kind of configure it with a whole bunch of widgets and different information that you might want to see. Well, and I can't remember how much I paid for it, but I bought it, and it was fairly decent. There was an article that Jason Snell over at Six Colors published this week of how to do some of the same types of things, but for free. And there's a little plugin called BitBar, which is a free utility that allows you to basically write little scripts and put anything you want on the menu bar.
Wow.
It's kind of cool. Now, I think this is the menu bar and not the toolbar, but if it's the toolbar, that would be even better. So I like to add features that provide me content that I want to look at.
Yeah, and place it in a spot where you can do something with it.
Yeah. So I thought this was an interesting article. Not going to spend much time on it other than, if you got some time, people, take a look at it. Let us know what you think.
All right. So people who've obviously spent oodles of time.
Oodles.
And I don't know how you would measure an oodle versus a plethora. I mean, it's a lot of time.
Well,
right?
There's actually two different sizes for oodles. Yeah. One is used by surveyors.
And one is used by
everyone else.
So you found this fantastic example of Battle for Middle Earth that has been under development by a group of fans, apparently.
Yeah.
For the last couple of years.
Yeah, so I really enjoyed Battle for Middle Earth. I like these types of real-time strategy games where you build a tech tree, and and you and I are both big Tolkien fans, and Lord of the Rings, wonderful movie, all 24 hours of it between that and The Hobbit, the extended editions. What I played a lot of it. It was really fun. And it was great for 2006 graphics technology. Well, the game has been getting a facelift by this group of fans, and they pretty much rebuilt the UI using Unreal. Unreal 4, I should say. And the video is about 18 minutes long. They go through where they are in their development cycle, and they have taken this and allowed you to zoom down to the orc level. The fidelity is incredible. The speed of redraw for all the different elements. I mean, they show a thing where they have, you know, like 100 or 200 orcs on the screen, as well as zooming it all the way down to individual flowers in a field waving in the wind.
Can you control a flower?
No, because there's wind. Wind controls the flowers. Darn. What they haven't done yet is made the collision detection between the orcs and the flowers. But they have between the orcs, because in the old game, the orcs would run through each other.
Ooh.
And here, they will actually go around, because they each individual orc has its own collision box. And it's just gorgeous. I love the game. I can't wait for them to finish this. I might actually have to reinstall the old game on my Windows machine and play it.
Looks pretty good. Unfortunately for me, no Windows box for yours truly, so won't be doing any of that. But I apologize for laughing while you were going through that little bit of a write-up, because in the if you like this, you'll like that, which was showing up on the same page. There is a desert bus style example of someone using Microsoft Flight Simulator to do a real-time 16-hour flight from LA to Dubai, and they recorded the whole thing.
That'll be in our show notes as a bonus episode for people.
My goodness, yeah, you just enjoy that. I don't know if you can watch 16 hours of it. Maybe you can. Wouldn't that be great? Enjoy it. If you watch it, report back. Yes. So, Michael, what are you planning on doing this weekend? Anything fun?
Same thing I do every weekend.
Try to take over the world?
Work. absolutely. Yeah, I'm doing work and some work for my nonprofit and a couple other things. I'll probably edit a podcast. Who knows?
Could happen.
What about you? Have you done any exciting outdoor adventures lately?
Oh, I've done a few. I've done, you know, a little bit of hiking, as I was mentioned before, around the neighborhood. But I'll tell you what I'm not going to be doing. What I'm not going to be doing is what apparently some people do in Cumbria on a porta ledge in England and kind of have a picnic on a ledge.
Not me. Not going to do it.
Like a cliff camping experience where you hang your feet over the edge and you're harnessed in, which is a good thing. But if you fell off the ledge while you're having a bite of your sandwich or whatever,
some Marmite
smacked up against, well, which, yeah, you could have Marmite. That's true. I was going to go, that's Australian. if you fell off, even with the harness, you'd probably go smack up against the face of the cliff. So it would warn you that you shouldn't fall off the ledge. So I'm like, yeah, I'd say that is something I'm definitely not going to do.
To paraphrase Jurassic Park,
So we're curious to know if there are any of our friends in the UK, if this would be attractive to you for a lovely weekend of something entirely different.
Insane.
Something completely different.
I think that puts us right out of time.
It does.
We do want to hear from you. You can follow us over at Twitter at games@work_biz and drop us a tweet or two. We would appreciate it. Or even better yet, go over to iTunes or your favorite podcasting directory. We are now also available, I think, on Amazon Music's podcast directory. At least we've signed up for it. We'll see if we're there. And who knows? Us a review. Give us 5 stars. Tell us what you like about the show, what you'd like us to talk about it, and we'd love to hear from you over at gamesatwork.biz.
See ya.
Bye.
You've been listening to You've been listening to GamesAtWork.biz, the podcast about gaming technology and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network, and would like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us on Twitter at GamesAtWork_biz or at our website at GamesAtWork.biz.